Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today, we're going to open by telling you about a petition that's been launched to save Lake Morena and Barrett Lake, which have been drained so low by the City of San Diego that residents contend there is not enough water to fight fires. And speaking of hot topics, we'll tell you about some important issues coming up on agendas across East County this week at local boards and commissions and councils, agenda items that could affect your water rates, where your energy comes from, and how council districts are redrawn, among other issues. We'll have some good news for you from our own staff about the latest 5 awards we've won from the Society of Professional Journalists for reporting that's making a positive difference here at East County Magazine. Learn how you can file to run for the Grossmont Union High School District Board, and then hear a warning from the Food and Drug Administration about mercury poisoning in skincare products and what you should know to stay safe. We'll tell you about a collaboration between San Diego State University and Lemon Grove to help plan some important projects in the region. Liz Alper will have an update on Aztec women's basketball in our sports report today. And then from Public News Service, we'll have the top daily national news, including the dilemma facing supporters of Bernie Sanders. And then on our Best of East County today, we'll be re-airing an interview with Roy Toft, a famous wildlife photographer who will be entertaining you about his adventures photographing tigers for National Geographic and more. We'll take you on the road to the Desert View Tower in Hacumba, and we'll tell you about a burning ban issued by CAL FIRE. We'll have all these stories and more, so please stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. An online petition at change.org has been launched asking the City of San Diego to stop draining Lake Morena and Barrett Lake here in East County. Rural residents seek help from San Diego residents and all who are concerned about wildlife or the prospect of a devastating firestorm to sign the petition. The petition, posted by Campo resident Karen McIntyre, accuses San Diego officials of ignoring public safety, noting that 2 residents died during the recent border fire. Firefighting aircraft were diverted to water sources farther away due to lack of water in the lakes, witnesses stated in recent public meetings. We have asked CAL FIRE to respond and thus far have not received a reply. The petition states that the city has put wildlife and rural communities at risk, also failing to live up to its promise to repair the dam at Lake Morena. The city drained Lake Morena to less than 3% of capacity and Barrett Lake to below 6%, public records indicate. Although San Diego claimed it needed drinking water during the drought, the city did not ask its residents to conserve water at all before draining East County's lakes. The water was pumped to Otay Reservoir, which overfilled when rain finally did fall, so the city dumped that precious water supply into the ocean. City officials have thus far ignored pleas from rural residents. A spokesperson for Mayor Kevin Faulkner advised East County Magazine that the city has no plans to take corrective action to reverse the damage or to reduce the risks to rural residents and wildlife. The draining commenced during Mayor Jerry Sanders' administration, but was ordered halted by Mayor Bob Filner to protect the public. However, that order was again changed after Filner left office and the draining resumed. The petition calls for the city to take 4 actions. Stop draining the lakes until water levels are restored through natural rainfall, which may take a while. Immediately repair the dam at Lake Morena. Balance needs of rural versus city residents as well as wildlife and groundwater impacts before making future water withdrawals, and keep at least a 50% capacity at both lakes in the future. You can find the petition, titled Save Lake Morena, at change.org and on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Tasha Matthews with an education report. For the first time, the Grossmont Union High School District will hold elections in November for individual trustee districts. In the past, trustees were elected at large for the entire district instead of representing specific communities. The candidate filing period opened July 18th and closes August 12th. August 12th is also the deadline for candidates to submit ballot statements, which for the first time will be accepted electronically. There are no filing fees, though modest fees are charged for candidates to publish ballot statements. With smaller districts, the cost for ballot statements is far less than in the past, just $315 in Trustee Area 1 and $360 in District 2. District 1 is an open seat with no incumbent. It includes Lemon Grove, Spring Valley, and La Prensa. District 2 is currently represented by Jim Sturinger. It includes La Mesa, Casa de Oro, and Mount Helix, and a part of Rancho San Diego. The other three trustee districts will not be up for election until 2018. Winning candidates will serve for a 4-year term. For guidelines and information, you can visit the websites for the Registrar of Voters and the Grossmont Union High School District.
This is Miriam Raftery with news about some important meetings coming up in East County this week that could impact your water rates, your energy bills, and redistricting of city council races. Helix Water District's board will vote on Wednesday on a hefty proposed rate increase to offset revenue losses that are due, ironically, to residents conserving water as they were asked to do. Two proposals would raise rates for the average water customer by 8.3% or 10.1%, and staff has recommended the higher of the two increases. The meeting will be held on Wednesday, August 3rd at 2 p.m. at the Helix Water District Boardroom, and that's located at 7811 University Avenue in La Mesa. La Mesa will hold a public meeting on whether to provide La Mesa residents with an option to buy electrical power through a community choice energy program as an alternative to SDG&E. The meeting will be held on Wednesday, August 3rd at 7 p.m. in the council chambers at La Mesa City Hall. Community choice programs enable cities to buy or generate power for residents and businesses in their communities. Supporters say these programs help consumers save money on utility bills since the ventures are not for profit. Cities can also opt to buy more power from renewable sources such as solar. Utility companies have opposed community choice programs, claiming these could jeopardize their investments in long-term power generation contracts. Also on Wednesday, Lakeside's Community Planning Group will hear a presentation by the San Diego Association of Governments and hold a public hearing on SANDAG's ballot measure proposing a half-cent hike in sales tax to fund transit, highway, open space, bike, and pedestrian projects countywide. The meeting starts at 6:30 at the Lakeside Community Center. However, Lakeside residents may want to arrive early. Since it's 6 o'clock, plans for proposed projects will be available for public viewing. Another important meeting this week is an educational workshop in El Cajon on a proposed ballot initiative that would establish district elections for city council races starting in 2018. Currently, council members are elected at large, meaning all voters in the city cast votes. Breaking the city up into 5 districts would mean the people in each district would elect their own council member. The workshop will be held on Thursday, August 4th at 7 p.m. at the Lexington Elementary School's auditorium. All residents are encouraged to attend and ask questions. Translation services will be available in Spanish and in Arabic. The workshop will educate residents on the ballot measure proposed by the city and on requirements of the California Voting Rights Act, which seeks to assure representation of minorities in communities. More workshops will be held in the coming months. Also on Thursday at 7 p.m., the Boulevard Community Planning Group will meet at the Boulevard Fire Training Room with an agenda packed with important items. A county groundwater geologist will give a presentation on local groundwater monitoring results. A discussion will also be held on legal updates over the controversial Tule Wind project, slated to start construction in September in McCain Valley on public recreational lands. The Protect Our Communities Foundation has filed an appeal with the Ninth Circuit Court, requesting a hearing by a full 10-judge panel after a 3-judge panel ruled against halting construction. A separate appeal was filed July 22nd by Backcountry Against Dumps, a nonprofit citizens group. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has indicated that it expects Iberdrola, the developer of Tule Wind, to seek take permits that would allow it to inadvertently kill golden eagles with no penalties. The federal and county governments have already approved most portions of Tule Wind. A hearing on a wind lease application on state land is expected to be heard by the State Lands Commission on October 13th here in San Diego. Boulevard Planning Group's agenda also reveals that the California Energy Commission has docketed an SDG&E proposal to increase import capacity on the Southwest PowerLink high-voltage lines by 500 to 1,000 megawatts at an estimated cost to ratepayers of $700 to $900 million. The utility also wants to reduce local capacity requirements in the San Diego area by converting part of existing infrastructure between Arizona and Bonita from AC to high voltage direct current, or HVDC, by 2025.
Firefighting planes had to halt operations for half an hour on the massive deadly sand fire in Santa Clarita to track down a person flying a drone in the fire zone. On Monday, the federal government announced a program to make a dent in the problem. So far this year, drones have interfered with operations on more than 15 other fires. The Department of the Interior is now partnering with private companies to get fire locations mapped out and sent to DJI, the country's biggest drone manufacturer. Christy Wiley with Interior's Office of Wildland Fire explains what happens next.
They put what's called a geofence or a virtual boundary around that fire. And so if you have a drone that goes across that boundary, then they send an alert to their drone operators.
The drone operators will get an immediate email or text alert telling them to back off. Earlier this year, the government put a new system in place where fire managers report drones to the Federal Aviation Administration, which alerts law enforcement officers who track down the violators. By law, all hobby drones must be registered with authorities. Wiley says drones are very dangerous because they can crash into a plane and hurt even more people if either the drone or plane comes hurtling toward the ground.
They're a hazard to the aircraft flying, and they're a hazard to the firefighters on the ground. The fire managers do not shoot drones down. They will just discontinue the air operations.
Wiley says this new system is a prototype that will be improved and expanded by the 2017 fire season. By then, the drone manufacturers hope to be able to actually prevent drones from operating in restricted airspace once they reach a geofence perimeter. The system could also be used to protect places with restricted airspace, like prisons and nuclear reactors. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Miriam Raftery with some good news to share. East County Magazine has received 5 awards in the Society of Professional Journalists San Diego Pro Chapter 2016 Journalism Awards Contest. Journalists honored included our editor, Miriam Raftery, yours truly, as well as reporters Mike Allen and Janice Russell, and our sound editors Ed Barena and Leon Thompson. The honors include a special First Amendment award with a $100 prize for our series on county efforts to suppress free speech. As a result of our coverage exposing this issue, the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, notified the county that its proposal to force protesters into free speech zones outside the county administration building was unconstitutional, and the county backed down. East County Magazine also won first place in the multicultural category for our story on local Chaldeans' efforts to obtain release of Iraqi Christians being held in an Otay immigration detention facility. Our coverage included written reporting for our website as well as audio coverage that ran on our radio show right here on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice. We also received second place in the political government category for reporting on Soytech backers hosting a fundraiser for Supervisor Dave Roberts just days after Roberts cast a vote for a controversial Soytech solar project in East County. In addition, East County Magazine received 2 honorable mentions, one for our news series titled Ambulance Responses in Our Region Raise Alarms, as well as a multicultural story on rising anti-Semitism worldwide. Congratulations to our talented and hardworking team.
This is Chisato Iverson with an important healthcare alert. Whatever your complexion, it's important to use products that help your skin and not damage it. But as you wade through the beauty aisles, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration cautions that you should avoid skin creams, beauty, and antiseptic soaps, and lotions that contain mercury. How will you know if mercury is in the cosmetic, especially one that's marketed as anti-aging or skin lightening? Check the label. If the words mercurous chloride, calomel, mercuric, mercurio, or mercury are listed on the label, mercury's in it, and you should stop using the product immediately. The products are usually marketed as skin lighteners and anti-aging treatments that remove age spots, freckles, blemishes, and wrinkles. Adolescents may use these products as acne treatments. Jason Humberts of FDA's Office of Regulatory Affairs says these products usually are manufactured abroad and sold illegally in the United States, often in shops catering to the Latino, Asian, African, or Middle Eastern communities. They are promoted online on social media sites and sold through mobile apps. Consumers may have also bought them in another country and brought them back to the U.S. If the ingredients aren't listed and there is no product label, don't assume it's fine. Federal law requires that the ingredients be listed on the label of any cosmetic or non-prescription drug, so do not use a product that does not have a label. Also, don't use drugs or cosmetics labeled in languages other than English, unless English labeling is also provided. That's also a sign that the product may be marketed illegally. The FDA does not allow mercury in drugs or in cosmetics, except under very specific conditions where there are no other safe and effective preservatives available. Sellers and distributors who market mercury-containing skin whitening or lightening creams in the U.S. may be subject to seizure of products or criminal prosecution. Exposure to mercury can have serious health consequences. The danger isn't just to people who use mercury-containing products, but also to their families. Dr. Arthur Simone, a senior medical advisor at the FDA, warns, "Your family might breathe mercury vapors released from these products. Your child might touch washcloths or towels that are contaminated with mercury. Merely touching the face of someone who used a skincare product could expose babies or children to mercury," Dr. Simone cautions. Some people, including pregnant women, nursing babies, and young children, are especially vulnerable to mercury toxicity, which can harm the developing brain and nervous systems of infants and small children. In the past few years, FDA and state health officials have discovered numerous products that contain mercury, and there have been cases in which people exposed to such products have had mercury poisoning or elevated levels of mercury in their bodies. While the FDA has worked to block shipments of products containing mercury from entering the U.S., many of the products are coming into the country through illegal channels, so it's important for the consumers and retailers to know about the dangers of the mercury poisoning from skincare products. If you have been exposed to mercury, thoroughly wash your hands and other parts of your body that have come in contact with the products. Then, contact your healthcare professional or medical care clinic for advice. You can also call the Poison Center, which is open 24 hours a day at 1-800-222-1222. Before throwing out a product that may contain mercury, seal it with a plastic bag or leak-proof container. Check with your local environmental, health, or solid waste agency for disposal instructions. Since communities often have special collection options for disposing of hazardous household waste.
San Diego State University has chosen Lemon Grove for its STAGE project, in which students partner with cities on projects ranging from helping the homeless to recreation and public art. Lemon Grove City Council has unanimously approved the SAGE partnership. The SAGE project at SDSU is modeled after the Sustainable City Year program, in which students gain experience by solving real-world problems while cities pay far less than if they were to hire professionals for that work. Mayor Mary Sessom and Vice Mayor George Gastel, both college educators, indicated the partnership is a win-win. Gastel stated, "For a small city, we have a lot of really good resources. The Lemon Grove Historical Society, one of the best county libraries, and 22 churches. For a city of 25,000, we have an awful lot to draw on. But at times, we're short on social capital." Lemon Grove applied for 14 projects. Those selected include parks and recreation programs, urban agriculture, public art, homelessness outreach and resources, infrastructure, signage, and more. The first 4 years of the SAGE project were dedicated to the cities of San Diego, Santee, and National City. In Santee, over 2,000 data points were mapped, testing waters to find pollution hotspots, and then customized mitigation techniques were recommended. National City ultimately hired 2 participants from the SAGE project, which is also creating jobs. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for August 1st, 2016. I'm Mary Sherman. Our stories feature a variety of topics, including as the Clinton and campaign campaigns pick up steam, some Sanders supporters wonder how to move forward, concerns raised about the dangers of guns on campus, and a lawsuit filed over a poultry project in Arkansas. Leading our news, supporters of Senator Bernie Sanders now face some big choices: whom to support in November, and what to do with the powerful grassroots organization behind his primary campaign. Suzanne Potter has more from Idaho.
Many say they're now taking another look at the third-party candidates. A.J. Conda, a Sanders delegate from Kootenai County, says he'll vote for Independent Party candidate Gary Johnson or Green Party candidate Jill Stein if it looks like one of them can win. But if they remain low in the polls, he's prepared to support the former First Lady.
We hate the lesser of two evils kind of vote, but even I think that we do need to vote for Hillary, if all else fails, in order to not get Trump.
Many Sanders supporters have said they're frustrated by the email scandal that showed some Democratic National Committee staffers had discussed ways to discredit the senator from Vermont.
Donald Trump has refused to release his tax returns so far,
But what could we learn if he did? Mark Horvitt, who heads the nonpartisan group Investigative Reporters and Editors, says tax reforms are one of the best ways to answer some of the most important questions about any candidate, not just Trump.
Who has influence over them or who they have influence over, where their financial interests lie. And when you look at whether they tend to favor certain things that could potentially directly benefit their income.
Horvitt says pushing to see Trump's returns isn't a partisan attack. He says when someone is wealthy and has a number of different income streams, journalists and researchers need those documents to provide the public with a clear financial portrait. Trump insists there's nothing to see in his tax returns and says he'll release them as soon as he is finished being audited. After exhaustive back and forth in the courts and public discourse over North Carolina's voter ID law and other changes put into place by lawmakers in 2013, a federal court finally laid down the law. Stephanie Carson has more on what it means.
A federal appeals court struck down the law on Friday, which means voters will not be required to provide photo ID at the polls this November. Mary Klenz with the League of Women Voters of North Carolina says the court's ruling left little room for interpretation of the law's constitutionality.
They give us a clear message that politicians have no business standing in the way of our right to vote. We're grateful to the Court of Appeals for seeing this bill for what it was.
The court ruling also restored voters' ability to register on Election Day and pre-register before reaching age 18. And it restored the original length of the early voting period and allows for out-of-precinct voting.
Should college students be allowed to carry guns to class? That's a big question in Wisconsin, as Tim Morrissey explains.
5 years ago, Wisconsin passed a law with a provision that colleges and universities must allow concealed carry on campus. But another provision to the law says guns can be banned from campus buildings if signs stating that guns are prohibited are posted at every entrance. That's what Wisconsin institutions of higher learning did to keep guns out. Now, with terror attacks making headlines nearly every week, some are calling for students to be armed. Mark Lovicott, spokesman for the UW-Madison Police Department, says it's a very bad idea.
We've heard from student groups, we've heard from faculty groups, we've heard from parents, we've heard from alumni who say they just don't want this to happen here. They feel as if the campus and other campuses across the state would be less safe, and they would feel less safe. And we agree with them, and we don't believe more guns are the answer.
After the law was passed in 2011, three Democratic members of the state assembly introduced a bill that would make carrying weapons on campus a Class 1 felony, but the idea never advanced in the Republican-controlled legislature.
Starting today, more than 280,000 Minnesotans will see bigger paychecks thanks to the state's new minimum wage increase. Brandon Campbell has more from the former state rep who helped get it passed.
The 50-cent wage bump goes into effect today for large employers who will now have to pay workers at least $9.50 an hour. For smaller businesses, the wage goes up to $7.75 an hour. In 2014, former state representative Ryan Winkler helped put the House version of the wage bill together. While the move still falls short of a livable wage, Winkler says it's a modest step in the right direction.
I would very much support the move to go to $15. I think that should be the national minimum. Earn sick leave.
Governor Mark Dayton supports the current wage increase, saying it will improve the lives of full-time workers in the state. But some Minnesota lawmakers and business owners have argued that the wage raise could force them to cut staff or raise prices for customers.
A lawsuit could be filed before summer wraps up over plans to build a new poultry plant in northeast Arkansas. The Animal Legal Defense Fund and the Arkansas Rights Coalition have sent a letter to the Farm Service Agency, the Small Business Administration, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Say they'll file suit within 60 days over a $1 million SBA loan to build the Tracy Poultry Project. It includes six large broiler chicken houses in the Strawberry River watershed. Attorney Jessica Bloom with the Animal Legal Defense Fund says factory farm waste poses a health threat to local endangered species.
The poultry litter is what is toxic to the environment. And that is over-applied or overspread on field as fertilizer. It can discharge or drain into these waterways and then start killing off these protected species.
Seven species in the area are listed as threatened. Alabama-based Peco Food says the plant would create 1,000 jobs. I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Liz Albert with an Aztecs women's basketball report. San Diego State women's basketball head coach Stacy Terry revealed the team's 2016 non-conference schedule Monday with an invitation to the Seton Hall tournament over Thanksgiving weekend and a December home date with Big Ten member Michigan, highlighting the Aztecs' 11-game slate. After engaging Cal State San Marcos in the squad's lone exhibition game on November 4th, SDSU officially raises the curtain on the 2016-17 campaign when it heads north to the Inland Empire to face UC Riverside on November 11th. The Aztecs will look to reverse a 2-game slide to the Highlanders, who captured the Big West Conference regular season championship last season and advanced to the WNIT. 3 days later, the Scarlet and Black returns to the friendly environs of Montezuma Mesa when it plays host to San Diego Christian on November 14th. The Aztecs will battle the Hawks for the second year in a row after posting a decisive 60-25 triumph at Viejas Arena in 2015. SDSU will remain in America's finest city for its next two encounters, traveling down Interstate 8 for its annual crosstown matchup with the University of San Diego on November 17th, before returning to Steve Fisher Court for a clash with Loyola Marymount on November 20th. The Aztecs have not met the Lions at home since December 2008, when they emerged with an 85-70 triumph. The following weekend, San Diego State will venture out for its farthest road trip in 2 years when it participates in the Seton Hall tournament in South Orange, New Jersey. The Aztecs will square off against Stacy Terry's alma mater, the University of Texas Arlington, in the opener at historic Balls Gymnasium on November 26th before facing either host Seton Hall or Central Connecticut State the next day on November 27th. The schedule eases up with just one game over the ensuing 11 days, with the Aztecs heading back out on the road to lock horns with UC Davis in Northern California on December 2nd. Prior to semester exams, SDSU will open a 2-game homestand starting December 9th when it takes on Michigan, followed by a matchup with UC Santa Barbara on December 11th. The Wolverines, who advanced to the semifinals of the WNIT last season, defeated the Aztecs 70-50 in the second game of the 2015 San Juan Shootout in the only previous meeting between the two sides. However, the Scarlet and Black has won 3 straight against the Gauchos, including the 64-58 victory at home in 2014. San Diego State will then face its 4th and final Big West opponent of the regular season just before the Christmas holiday when it invades Orange County for a battle with Cal State Fullerton on December 22nd. The Aztecs have captured 7 straight games against the Titans dating back to 1994, including the 54-43 win at Steve Fisher Court a year ago. SDSU last visited Titan Gym in December 2003 when it prevailed by a 73-50 count. In their final tune-up before a conference play on December 28th, the Aztecs will welcome Biola University to Viejas Arena, marking the first matchup between the two teams in 33 years. SDSU has played the Eagles 6 times in program history, but not since 1983, when it registered a huge 99-59 victory. For the 4th consecutive year, the Aztecs will play 18 Mountain West games, beginning with the conference opener at New Mexico on Saturday, December 31st.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part 2 of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome. This is Mimi Pollack, host of East County Magazine's Animal Tales. Welcome to Animal Tales. This is Mimi Pollack. I am here today with Ramona wildlife photographer Roy Tuft. Not only is he a renowned photographer with pictures appearing in National Geographic magazine, he also offers guided tours to Africa, Costa Rica, and Alaska. Tuft got his degree as a wildlife biologist, so the focus of these tours is showing you how to photograph indigenous wildlife while having adventures in the wild. Welcome, Roy.
Thanks for having me, Mimi. Happy to be here.
How did you get into wildlife photography?
Well, I was the crazy kid in Poway with the garage full of snakes, right? So right away, everybody knew I loved animals. And so I grew up loving animals, getting out in our local chaparral and watching the hawks and catching snakes and enjoying that. Went on to get a wildlife degree from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in Northern California and got my first camera as I graduated from college and started taking pictures of what I loved.
What type of camera was it?
It was a Canon AE-1, which was kind of a classic old film camera.
And so the camera inspired you to start taking pictures and combining both the wildlife degree along with the photography.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the animals that were the major interest, and the photography is kind of a stimulus to get you out there, right? And it keeps you out there longer. So it's just kind of a natural thing to want to enjoy your subjects more. You can take images of them and enjoy them when you're back home.
And besides Costa Rica and Alaska, what countries have you been to in Africa, and what other countries have you been to in the world where you've done wildlife photography?
Wow, good question. I've been to, I should count the number of countries I've been to, but in the last 30 years of doing wildlife photography, I've been pretty much all over the world, from Antarctica to Japan and Indonesia and Australia, New Zealand, most of the countries in Africa and Central and South America. So yeah, I guess it'd be easier to say very few places I haven't been at this point.
And after college, how did you move into becoming more of a professional wildlife photographer?
Well, right after college, I started working at the Wild Animal Park here in San Diego. I guess now it's called the Zufari Park, which is always hard for me to remember. And I was doing the bird show there. And it's kind of I think anybody that's been in San Diego for a while knows that bird show. It's been there for 30 years. So I was happy that they asked me to join them there at the bird show. And being at the Wild Animal Park every day, doing my job at the bird show, of course, I'm surrounded by beautiful wildlife, even though it's not really wild, but it gave me an opportunity to get out during breaks and lunch hours with my camera and start taking imagery and work on it and get better at it. And so that really got me going into wildlife photography.
And how did you get connected to National Geographic magazine?
One of my last years working at the park, we had a National Geographic photographer come to the park doing a story on new zoos. And his name was Michael Nick Nichols, really a world-renowned photographer who's done dozens and dozens of stories for National Geographic. Well, everybody at the park knew I was into photography pretty heavily at that point. So they asked Nick if he needed an assistant, and I helped him on that new zoos project. So that kind of got me, you know, a little bit in working with National Geographic. And a couple years later, I went and did a 2-year project with Nick on tigers that we spent 2 years photographing wild tigers. And that was kind of the start of my career and a wonderful, you know, mentorship for me to be working with such a well-known and terrific photographer as Nick.
Okay. Tell me more about those 2 years photographing tigers. For example, what exactly did you do while you were there? How did you help Nick? And do you have any memorable moment or story that you can tell us from those years?
Sure. Yeah. So we were working in India, which has the largest population of tigers. And a big part of the story, of course, is doing a natural history portion of the project. So we spent over 2 years photographing a female tiger raising cubs. And so we basically go out every day at 4:30 in the morning on elephant back, because that's the easiest and most accessible way to be close to tigers is to be on top of an animal that they're not really that nervous about. 7 days a week for 3 months per trip to India. So we did 3 of those for the natural history portion. And we were photographing tigers, and we'd spend about 10 hours a day in the field and only see tigers about every 5 days on average. So it was a lot of time in the field for very little, you know, return, but it was definitely worth it.
But didn't you also do some groundbreaking work with remote cameras?
Yes, Nick was just really pushing the limits with remote cameras in the field, and tigers being a difficult animal to photograph in person and at close range. He set up 7 remote cameras in the jungle with my help. And my main job was to keep those remote cameras running 24/7. A remote camera, if you don't know, is a system where there's an infrared beam and the animal basically breaks that beam and takes his own picture. And that allowed us to take wide angle, very intimate shots of tigers that have never been done before. And that was one of our main ways of getting that kind of unique imagery of tigers while we were there.
That sounds very interesting. I imagine you must have gotten some incredible photographs with the remote cameras. Is there any one particular picture that you remember that comes to mind? Or
yeah, actually, and just for the listeners at home, if you have kind of that stack of National Geographic magazines on your library wall. It's 1997, December is the cover issue. And one of the pictures in there was a 50-page story. So it was a huge Nat Geo article. One of the pictures, I placed a camera on a vertical dry waterfall. So it's a rock wall. And we had seen a male tiger jump that chasm in where the water would be running if it was actually wet and to get to another water source. And so we put this camera, set it up so he's jumping right into a 20-millimeter wide lens, which is a very unique perspective. And that camera was there for 3 months, and we had one picture from that 3 months, and it's in the issue, and it's amazing, you know, a male tiger jumping right into the camera midair. So it's one of those, you know, pictures you'd never get in person. You'd have to kind of use this system of remote cameras, and it's much more common nowadays, but when Nick did it, and we did it for the Tiger Project, it was really revolutionary.
I remember that issue. It was just amazing. Now tell me about a memorable moment.
Another memorable moment with tigers is, as I mentioned earlier, we spent a lot of time in elephants following tigers and photographing them, you know, straight and not with a remote camera. Well, at one time, Nick was on one elephant. I was on another elephant. And we have our mahouts, or our drivers, driving the elephants. And we had this one male tiger named Charger that was in this tall grass. And we backed our elephants into the grass to be able to photograph from a perspective down into the grass. And obviously went too close to the tiger as he was feeling pressured. He came up on the back of Nick's elephant, actually jumped onto the rear of the elephant.
Wow.
Which was exciting for everyone, especially the elephants. So the elephants just started spinning and screaming, and we, you know, Nick and I held on for dear life
and they rotated fast.
Yes, they just spun, you know, just like tornadoes and just sent the tiger flying, and it was quite an exciting moment. You know, like most things with wildlife photography, when instances like this happen, you know, it's usually because we do something wrong, and it was obviously our fault. We pushed we asked the elephants to get too close to the tiger, and he just did what was natural for a tiger, which is, you know, get out of here. And of course, he did it in a very traumatic fashion.
That was probably scary and exciting at the same time.
Yeah, certainly.
And then after, when you finished with doing the tiger shoot, what was the next project you worked on?
Well, after the tiger project, I came home and rested for a while because that was a long project. I actually did an assignment for Audubon magazine where I went and photographed ocelots in Texas. And it's another cat, a smaller spotted cat. And a lot of people don't know we have ocelots in the United States.
I didn't know that. Ocelots in Texas. What part of Texas?
Yeah, this was in near Laguna Atascosa, so it's way, way south Texas. The majority of ocelots are found in Central and South America. So this is just kind of a small population coming up into Texas.
Are they endangered?
They are endangered. There's only about 50 ocelots left in Texas in the United States. And so, yeah, I was also using remote cameras again to photograph this elusive cat.
And then what was your next big shoot after that?
Wow. Next big shoot after that. I did another project for Audubon on a rainforest photography and birds. So that was another cover story for Audubon magazine.
I remember you told me about wolves, that you did something up in Alaska with wolves.
Yeah, you know, right out of college, as I mentioned, I was a wildlife biology major, and right out of college, I did a wolf population study up in Alaska for the summer. It was, you know, merely a 3-month project putting collars on wolves so we could do a population study. So that was my first time in the field with my new camera, so that was a kind of an exciting time for me.
And then also for, like, I believe it was 3 years, you and your wife opened up a gallery up in Solana Beach on Cedros Avenue, right?
Yeah, we had a beautiful gallery on Cedros in Solana Beach, and it was my wife's idea to kind of show my art to people and be able to have a gallery. And And it was fun. We did that and met a lot of local people. It was when we first moved back to San Diego in the early 2000s. You know, we moved back in 2005.
Where did you live before then?
We were up in the Bay Area for about 8 years, up in Half Moon Bay on the coast south of San Francisco.
But you are a local San Diego boy, right? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I actually grew up in Poway. So we moved to Poway in 1970. Yeah, I grew up here, went to high school here, went off to college in Northern California, and then we moved around a bit and then came back to kind of the motherland here in Ramona in 2005.
What do you like about living in Ramona?
We love the wilderness experience we have in Ramona. You know, we live on big acreage, which you can still find here in the East County, which is great. And so it's peaceful.
How many acres?
We have 40 acres.
Wow.
Yeah, and
nice.
It's in kind of the big boulder country up there near Mount Woodson, so it's beautiful. Lots of local wildlife. You know, I don't always have to jump on an airplane to get my camera out and photograph wildlife. In fact, this last week, I've spent every morning in a blind photographing our small indigenous fox, our California gray fox, something that actually I've spent no time photographing fox all my years here. They're kind of a tough animal to see. We often see coyotes a lot more, but this is a little bit smaller canid that is more nocturnal, quite a bit more elusive than coyotes. And they're just beautiful. They have a gray color with a cinnamon rust on the chest and their shoulders. Gorgeous, big fluffy tail. And this week I was sitting in a blind photographing a den with five kits. And that's what they call young foxes. So what a great, you know, here I am in my backyard. I got my coffee and I walk across the valley, get in my blind and photograph beautiful foxes right here in San Diego County.
I know. I've seen the pictures. They're amazing. Now, you mentioned to me earlier that you have a teaching credential and you enjoy working with people. And so you mentioned to me that in the year 2000, you started organizing photographic expeditions where you would take people to different countries and teach them how to photograph wildlife. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big part of my business now is leading photographic tours or safaris. And, you know, it's never a better time than now to take photos. You know, the digital era and digital cameras have made it so much more accessible for people. You know, you're not spending a ton of money on film. You know, you're getting instant feedback from these little TV screens. So you can really progress much quicker than the old days with film. And so, you know, people are finding they want to go out instead of going on a typical vacation and going to some beach and sitting on the beach or going golfing, that there's this whole other avenue for vacations. And, you know, you can combine wildlife viewing, traveling, and learning, you know, something new and exciting. And that's what I do in these wildlife tours. You know, I bring people to Africa or Brazil or Alaska for bears or Mexico, and Costa Rica is one of my all-time favorite destinations. It's close and you have a rainforest right there. So it's a wonderful way to get people out in the field and, you know, try out a new camera, or if they're already an experienced photographer, it's wonderful to go with a pro that already gives you, taking you to the best spots and the best lodges. And so that's a big part of my business. In fact, this year I'll be in the field 160 days running my photo tours.
For those of you who just tuned in, this is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, East County Magazine. Now, I want to go into more detail about these trips. For example, what countries do you go to in Africa?
My main country I go to in Africa is Botswana, a lovely country. It's just north of South Africa, so it's in the southern part of the continent. And I've been going there. This will be my 14th year leading tours to Botswana, so obviously I love it. It's spectacular wildlife. Most people perhaps have heard of the Okavango Delta, which is a very well-known area. It's a floodplain and a desert that creates this oasis for wildlife. And so that's my main destination. Although I have to say next week, I'm going to Tanzania in East Africa, leading a photo trip there. So a couple different countries in Africa I go to.
Getting back to Botswana, do some people go there because of the books, the number one ladies detective agency? Do they ever go there and ask you about that? Or?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I mean, people who go to Botswana, of course, read those books because it's such an interesting series. and it's based in Botswana. I don't think it's the reason they go, obviously, because it's really the wildlife that brings them there, but it's a nice connection.
Yeah. And when people go to Africa, they must think that, you know, they're going to be roughing it, or why don't you tell us? Because I remember you mentioned to me that you want people to know that going to Africa is not going to be roughing it, that it's actually going to be a very pleasant experience in terms of lodging and food and how they take care of you. Why don't you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I get that a lot, Mimi. I get, you know, isn't it dangerous and aren't you afraid going to Africa? And I think so much of the media reports of, you know, they generalize when they're speaking of the entire continent of Africa, when there's, you know, there's epidemics of something going on or a little bit of violence somewhere. It's a huge continent. And, you know, we're going to a place that's very safe. In fact, the most dangerous part of your African safari will be driving to the airport here in Limburg Field. I mean, being in your car statistically is more dangerous than any other part of the trip. And we're taken care of. It's just really amazing the service level that we get on, in our trips to Africa, the lodging, the food, the wine. Yeah, everything is 5-star. So there's absolutely no roughing it. You know, I have clients that are kind of wonder what big hiking boots they should buy to bring on my trip. And I have to tell them that, you know, I wear Crocs, the most comfortable light slip-on shoe, because we're in vehicles all day. We're not going on death marches. We're not hiking. We're driving around in wonderful vehicles and viewing this wildlife very close and photographing it and then going back for wonderful dinners and wonderful lodging. So it's, you know, it's nothing that you have to worry about roughing it. It's very much a luxury vacation.
I've also heard that the African people themselves are very friendly and very welcoming.
They really are. They are just over the top friendly, just smiles from ear to ear at all times. And so it's a wonderful cultural experience. People that just don't get to travel that much, if it's based on fear, get out there and see some other places around the world, because people are people. And when you go to these communities, they're just so welcoming. And, you know, it's such a joy to see people from around the world and get a different perspective. If you're just always in one location, it's tough to view the world in more than one perspective. So yeah, get out there and travel and see the world and see some beautiful places. That's what I like to do.
Now, what about for the more outdoorsy types, the ones that want to go hiking, the ones that want to have more of an outdoor adventure? What country would you recommend that they take a photographic tour with you, but to where? Like, for somebody who's, you know what I'm talking about, somebody's more of an outdoorsy hiking.
Yeah, if you don't want to be in a vehicle the entire time and you want to get out and physically, you know, hike and enjoy the environment. I actually have several that do that. Costa Rica is a great one. It's close. It's an easy flight. Within 6 hours, you're in prime rainforest and seeing, you know, 4 species of monkeys and tropical birds, toucans and parrots. It's really mind-boggling, you know, in this day and age. You can just get away for 6-8 hours and you're in this amazing tropical environment. So that's one we definitely get out and hike and experience that rainforest. As I mentioned earlier, I was just in Chile photographing pumas, our mountain lion, same cat. And it's possible there to photograph them on foot. And so we do a lot of hiking in Torres de Peña National Park in Chile. So that's definitely high up. People really want to get their heart rate up and do some hiking along with photography and wildlife viewing. Then that's a great destination.
And now what about Alaska? Tell us about your tours to Alaska.
Well, Alaska is another location that's close and easy to get to. And, you know, we have our own Serengeti right here in the United States, and that is Alaska. So there's nothing like the open spaces up there. I've been leading bear trips up there for over 10 years. And so this is a brown bear excursion where we're out, you know, on foot, hiking and photographing the feeding brown bears. They're feeding on salmon in August on the different rivers in Alaska. So it's another thrilling, large carnivore photography adventure. But once again, we're staying on a boat and it's amazing food and, you know, catching our own halibut and king crab and not much roughing it there either. I guess I'm getting older, Mimi, so I don't want to rough it either. So I like to go to destinations that we can, you know, have a nice place to stay and good food and enjoy each other's company and still get out and see wildlife.
Well, you're definitely a people person, so I can see how you would have fun leading these tours. For those of you who just tuned in, this is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, East County Magazine, and this is Mimi Pollack, and I'm talking to wildlife photographer Roy Tuft. Now, what would you say for when you take your people on these tours to Africa, Costa Rica, Alaska, Chile? Tell me two tips to be able to do successful wildlife photography.
Two tips. I think the first thing is patience. When we go out with wildlife, it's not like going to a studio or going to the zoo or where things are just going to perform for you. So I really, you know, I have to set expectations for my clients that we're going to extremely rich areas for wildlife, but there's still an element of being patient. The animals aren't there to please you or entertain you. We're just going in their environment. And obviously I'm taking people to very productive areas where we're going to see some great stuff. But, you know, just be happy to be there. And, you know, and that's my job, is to get you in the right spot at the right time and to have wonderful wilderness experiences.
Nice. Is there a website people can go to find out more information?
Sure. My website is toftphoto.com. So my last name, T-O-F as in Frank, T, photo, P-H-O-T-O.com. And, you know, you can get on there. I have lots of different links to photography and wildlife. I actually have a tours and workshops page. So you want to get on there to see where I'm going, what I'm doing, and feel free to shoot me an email.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And if you would like more information about Roy, look for my article that's coming up in East County Magazine. This is Mimi Pollack of Animal Tales. Thank you very much.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. County Parks and Recreation will close 4 parks in the month of August, a precaution taken each year due to the month's expected extreme heat. El Capitan Preserve near Lakeside, Mount Gower Preserve near Ramona, Hell Hole Canyon Preserve in Valley Center, and Wilderness Gardens in Pala are closed from August 1st through August 31st. In addition, Agua Caliente Regional Park in the desert is closed all summer long and will reopen Labor Day weekend. Luckily, there are nearly 100 other county parks and preserves to explore during the month of August, and you can find more about those by visiting sdparks.org.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Hayden Parsley, on the road in Hucumba Hot Springs for East County Magazine. You can take a trip into California's past at the Desert View Tower, a quirky and whimsical relic of the past that is still open to the public here in San Diego's East County. Located just off Interstate 8 at the Incapa exit, the tower is poised on a rocky overlook surrounded by desert on all sides. Built in the 1920s by Bert Vaughn, a real estate tycoon who owned much of Hucumba, this 70-foot watchtower has become a tourist attraction and a local landmark on the outskirts of the small town known as Hucumba Hot Springs. Originally built to commemorate the area's rough pre-highway history, the tower houses a small museum filled with artifacts and oddities of California's history, including our region's Native American, Spanish, and pioneer past. The top floor of the tower is an observation deck, with a coin-fed telescope that provides a breathtaking view of Imperial Valley and the Anza-Borrego Desert, though now somewhat marred by a wind farm. In 1950, a gift shop was added around the base of the tower. The shop still operates today and is filled with an eclectic mix of items such as geodes, gems and minerals, vintage postcards, historic and travel books on our region, arts and crafts items such as handmade Tecate tiles, onyx bookends, musical instruments, carved animal sculptures, and more. Roaming this area of the tower are the owner's many friendly dogs that add to the rustic charm of the location. You can also get a workout pumping a player piano while listening to old-time tunes. While I was there, the wind was gusting. It was a bit chilly and I wished I had a better coat when I reached the top. The owner says this is atypical though, and that it is warm and sunny most days. The proprietor, Ben Schultz, has many colorful stories on East County's history, culture, and colorful characters, having operated the site for many years. Boulder Park at the Desert View Tower was created in 1933 by an unemployed engineer, Merle Ratcliffe, who was out of work during the Great Depression. He sculpted reptiles and fanciful animals out of the huge stone boulders. I didn't get a chance to tour these, which will be an adventure for another time.
This is Leon Thompson with a public service announcement from CAL FIRE. While recent rains this winter and spring have been a welcome sight in California, drought conditions continue to increase fire danger in the region. That's prompted CAL FIRE to suspend all burn permits for outdoor residential burning within the state responsibility areas of San Diego and Imperial counties. Effective immediately, this ban prohibits residential outdoor burning of landscape debris such as branches and leaves. CAL FIRE and County Fire Chief Tony Meacham says, San Diego lives with the threat of wildfire year-round, and it is critical that the public do their part to be extra safe when outdoors. CAL FIRE Director Chief Ken Pimlott advises, as conditions across California are drying out further, we must take every step to prevent new wildfires from sparking. Residents must ensure they have defensible space by removing dead trees and overgrown vegetation from around their homes, but do so safely. Since January 1, 2016, CAL FIRE and firefighters across the state have already responded to over 1,700 wildfires that have burned nearly 30,000 acres. In the CAL FIRE San Diego unit, firefighters have responded to over 75 wildfires. While outdoor burning of landscape debris by homeowners is no longer allowed, CAL FIRE is asking residents to ensure that they are prepared for wildfires by maintaining a minimum of 100 feet of defensible space around every home. Here are some tips that can help prepare homes and property. Clear all dead and or dying vegetation 100 feet from around all structures. Landscape with fire-resistant and fire-retardant plants. Find alternative ways to dispose of landscape debris like chipping or hauling it to biomass energy facilities. The department may issue restricted temporary burning permits if there is an essential reason due to public health and safety. Agricultural land management, fire training, and other industrial-type burning may proceed if a CAL FIRE official inspects the burn site and issues a special permit. The suspension of burn permits for residential landscape debris does not apply to campfires and organized campgrounds. For additional information on how to create defensible space, as well as tips to prevent wildfires, visit readyforwildfire.org.
A boycott of six Vons, Ralph's, and Albertsons grocery store locations is underway starting this past Monday. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union in San Diego has announced, if no contract agreement is reached by August 8th, the union has voted to call a strike against all the store's locations throughout Southern California. The boycott locations include two in East County, the Vons store on University Avenue in La Mesa, and the Albertsons supermarket on Campo Road in Spring Valley. Other locations include Ralph's stores in Mission Valley and San Marcos, a Vons in Encinitas, and an Albertsons in Chula Vista. Union leader Mickey Kasperian states in a post on the UFCW webpage that the union attended bargaining sessions on July 20th and 21st, fully prepared to bargain a mutually acceptable contract, but he wrote in his message to workers, Albertsons, Vons, and Ralph's did not share this intention and their proposals continue to fail to recognize your hard work. The company's profitability and the increasing cost of living in Southern California is not acceptable. The issues include wages, pensions, and health care. East County Magazine's news partner, 10 News, reached out to Vons, Albertsons, and Ralph's. Vons and Albertsons spokesman Carlos Illingworth called the boycott an unfortunate distraction that won't impact the outcome of the negotiations. He said the issues are complex, adding, we are working hard to find a settlement that is fair to our employees, good for our customers, and allows our company to remain competitive. Negotiations will resume on August 1st. Meetings for all union members have been scheduled for August 8th to vote to accept or reject management's offer. Workers have already voted to strike if a deal is not reached. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chisato Everson.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.